The Recipes for Life podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed the health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com. Brian Sanders is a filmmaker and the creator of Food Lies, about what humans are supposed to eat, where we went wrong in the last 60 years, and how to fix this all, featuring experts like Tim Noakes, Nina Tscholtz, Ted Naiman, Sean Baker, Amy Berger, and more. Brian also has an incredible podcast called Peak Human, where he's interviewed experts, doctors, and researchers, many of whom will be in the film. To find out more about Brian and Food Lies, visit foodlies.org, foodlies.org. Brian, thank you so much for being a part of our podcast today, and I'm really looking forward to having this chat because I feel like you and I are talking the same language when it comes to what we would like to see in the world. And so thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. I feel like we're definitely on the same page, and I'm really excited to talk about all this stuff.
So you were creating a film at the moment called Food Lies. And I just love that title, Food Lies, because there are so many food lies out there. And from what I've seen of what you're actually putting into your film, I think it is going to have a tremendous effect on anybody that watches it. So let's start off with why Brian Sanders has endeavored to create this film, and what is it that gets you up in the mornings to keep persevering at this?
Yeah, well, I have multiple things that led me to this. For, you know, my parents had problems with chronic disease, and they ate foods that we thought were healthy our whole life, but it turned out that they weren't doing them any good. And, you know, my dad actually passed away of cancer, and my mom has stage 4 Alzheimer's. And they both had problems with their weight and insulin. And I just think it was avoidable, right? So I've been lucky enough to be in shape my whole life. And I stumbled upon this more, you know, paleo ancestral way of eating. And I got to the next level. You know, it was really amazing the differences just cutting grains and sugar were when I was already healthy person. So that really astounded me. I'm like, well, how many other people out there are thinking they're healthy, but don't even know that they're not, or that there's a next level of health out there? So those are probably the two main reasons. And then I saw What the Health, and I couldn't handle these lies, right? That's the main lies, I think, come from vegan propaganda. And it's hard because they come at it from a loving and, you know, moral perspective, but they just have a lot of things wrong and spreading some bad information, I think.
Yeah. So let's delve a little bit deeper into that then. So your personal desire is to stop and hopefully put a message out there that can alleviate the pain that you went through witnessing your family struggle with bad health. But what I'm finding fascinating as well is you thought you were healthy and you basically upgraded your health. And that's a really interesting thing, because most people that I know of
come to an ancestral or a paleo or ketogenic approach because their health has deteriorated to the point where they're just like, I need to change something. And I've tried everything. Yeah. And I guess the last possible option that's available to me is to change the way that I eat, when it should be probably the first thing that springs to people's minds. So tell me how you were, and then how you felt afterwards after you changed, and what was it that solidified this for you? And did you have your beliefs questioned and challenged?
Yeah, yeah. It was kind of a slow process. And I had friends that started figuring this stuff out before I did. You know, they'd read Mark's Daily Apple with Mark Sisson and, you know, kind of clue me in on it. And I gradually was like, oh, okay, maybe I'll check this out. And I dabbled. But I was fine, you know, like I was in shape. I thought I was fine, but I had like sort of chronic problems with my wrists. You know, I was working at the computer and there's sort of inflammation that wouldn't go away for 8 years. And it's just little things that I didn't really think that added up to much. And then I slowly started going less carbs, less grains, less sort of inflammatory things. And I was fine for a while. But it really didn't click when I really got fat adapted. You know, when I really, I've never done keto specifically. I've never measured ketones, but when I really just cut down on those grains and sugars, my body changed in amazing ways. I got way leaner. I got, you know, I felt stronger. My brain felt better. I had more energy, and the inflammation in my wrists went away, and I was able to work at the computer a lot easier.
Where did you get to on this journey for you as far as your realizations?
Yeah, well, I guess I realized, so that made me realize how much we got wrong. That's what really spurred the film, is these simple things that not many people are doing made such a big difference. So then I started looking into the history of everything, right? Then I started questioning these dietary recommendations that were given. And I just went down this rabbit hole, and I actually quit my job. And, you know, I started as a mechanical engineer, and then I got into tech. And then, you know, I don't have, I do have a film background growing up, but I kind of got back into film. And so I put all these things together when I started realizing that there were so many problems with people are trying to lose weight. No one's trying to be fat and sick, right? They're trying hard. Most of them are trying hard, but they've just been given the wrong information. And it was just sad to see you're spending time, you're spending money, right? You're spending willpower trying to do these things that are supposed to make you healthy. And you're eating whole grains and, you know, low fat yogurt and all this stuff, and it's not working. And then they just think that they're doomed and that they're meant to be like this. And that was really big for me when I just was mad. I'm just, you know, mad that I grew up eating these foods and that my parents thought were being healthy. So I just think there need to be something to change this just conventional wisdom. And, you know, I didn't know that you were making the magic pill the whole time that I was starting this. So it was really great to see that out there. I was already, you know, well underway with this, but I love that you told a lot of the same stories that I want to tell. So I'm hope to just take it one step further.
Yeah, and for sure. And that's what this is about. It's about putting more information out there from as many different outlets as possible, and solidifying that message for people and showing that. And, you know, the magic pill was a culmination of two seasons of TV that I created with my friend Rob Tate. So we did eight 30-minute episodes called The Paleo Way. And then we did a second season of that, which I self-funded. And it was a basic cooking show. Just a standard cooking show, 3 to 4 recipes per episode. And we featured some amazing people, all the people in the ancestral and paleo community. We went and interviewed to integrate them into a cooking TV series. And at the end of that, it didn't really get the, I couldn't really distribute it anywhere. I gave it to one of the largest distributors in the world, TV distributors. I'm saying, this is 4 or 5 years ago. Here's the new TV show. The cookbooks around the world, or in especially in Australia and New Zealand and America, the top selling cookbooks were on paleo and ancestral diets and low carb. And it's funny, but the TV side of things hadn't caught onto this. So I was like, I'm going to make this because it's relevant. And the distributor's just like, we cannot find a home for this because people don't know whether it's a cooking show or a documentary or a science show. And I'm like, yeah, it actually is all of that. Mm-hmm. You know, why does it have to fit into a certain genre for it to be this? And, yeah, you know, even my first series of The Paleo Way is still with a distributor that it hasn't been able to get an audience. But the second series I've put out, and it's about to come out on Netflix, actually.
Oh, great.
And it's also on iTunes. So from that all, I was like, geez, we've got so much information here from all the experts that we filmed. What can we do with it? Because the TV world isn't there. And I thought, maybe I could turn this into a documentary. And I spoke to Rob, who was the director on the TV series. I said, can we turn this somehow into a documentary? And he's like, yep. We'll follow some people, we'll do it, and we'll put it out there. And it's funny, a 90-minute film has been more, and it's spread like wildfire, more so than this amazing tool of basically 16 half-hour episodes showing people how to do this. And, you know, I've probably hit less than 1% of what the magic pill has, and the magic pill doesn't really teach people what to do as such. It offers solutions, but it doesn't give them the practical, hey, now here's how you do it. And so it's this really funny thing that I'm sitting with. And I love that we're able to have this chat, because I guess what you're bringing to the table is the next iteration of the magic pill, and you're putting more into it, and you're hopefully going to scratch people's interests to go, okay, there's more to go with this. So thank you for that. And thanks for letting me have my little summation of how this happened.
No, it's great. It's great to know how it happened. And yeah, I think people love that format of a film, that 90 minutes, you know, you get to, maybe the TV, it's too long, or it just isn't as concise. And so, yeah, this modern day and age, maybe, you know, people are short attention spans, but I think it's a great format. You know, I've been researching this for a long time, and this is the ultimate format. It's a 95-minute thesis that's audio and visual, right? That's right. You get graphics, you get emotional stories, you get everything to give out your thesis. And I think that's the best thing you can do to spread the information.
And I guess when you went down this rabbit hole through Mark Sisson and you talked about Ancestral, you must have encountered the work of Weston A. Price. So let's talk about that for a minute, because a lot of people probably have heard the name or they haven't heard the name. And it was actually the first book that was introduced to me by a friend of mine called Pete Meloff. He goes, the only book you need to ever read about health and nutrition is Weston A. Price's Physical and Nutritional Degeneration, the revised edition. If you can read that from cover to cover, you probably don't need to read any other book on the face of the planet when it comes to health. So I want to know how you came and what your realizations were. And if you could talk about Weston A. Price's work for us, for the people that have never heard.
Yeah. Yeah, I did read every word of it. It was a grind, but there's so much good information there. I read in a weird way too. I read the general stuff first, and then I went back to read about each culture. But yeah, he was in the 1930s, he traveled around the world and looked at all the civilizations that were still untouched by Western society, and looked at what they ate and what they didn't eat. And he was a dentist, and they found that all of these people had amazing health, and that correlated directly with their mouth health and their teeth and their wide dental arches, their great features, their faces, everything was perfect how humans were supposed to be. And he attributed this to diet, which is a very easy thing to figure out. And he saw that when the Western foods came in, you know, these people would trade, or, you know, once they were contacted by Western society, they'd start getting the sugar and the flour and vegetable oils, and immediately their health would deteriorate. And he could look at people, individual families, you know, between the younger brother and the older brother, when this happened, and the older brother eating the natural foods was perfectly healthy, no cavities, perfect teeth, and the younger brother who started eating all the processed foods had terrible problems, malnutrition, tons of cavities. It's just so easy to see. So that's why I think it resonates with so many people, and with you and with me, is this was a time when we could see it wasn't a scientific study, but it was almost better than a scientific study.
So what was the realization for you and for Weston A. Price? And are there some simple takeaway home truths or common sense truths and that can never be, I guess, debated? What was the message for you?
Yeah. Well, I thought it was really interesting. What really struck a chord with me is that all these populations, they're so diverse. You know, we went to the top of the Swiss Alps, to the islands in, you know, the middle of nowhere. And they all had the same practices or the same traditions. And they all figured this stuff out naturally, is that to eat nutrient dense foods, and these, they had these special foods that they'd give to people who were pregnant or women, even before they were married, and men, they would have these traditions all around the world. They somehow, a lot of them aligned, and that it was about these nutrient dense animal foods a lot. So a lot of nutrient dense animal foods and plant foods. So that would be organ meats and fish eggs and oysters and all this stuff like that. And they all ate these around their pregnancy, and they knew that that would give them healthy children. And that was really surprising to me. And it made a lot of sense. And I can see that that's what we've gotten away from. We're eating a lot of this modern processing of foods is just lowering the nutrient density, when throughout history, all of our food technology has been based around improving nutrient density of foods. Anything that we've ever done, whether from cooking or using tools to slice or sprouting grains or fermenting foods, all of that is around improving nutrient density. And everything we do now is the opposite of that, right? We're putting a bunch of excess refined sugars and grains and vegetable oils into foods, and that's just diluting the nutrients. It's getting less protein, vitamins, and minerals to our bodies. So that really stood out to me.
And I guess the interesting thing about Weston A. Price's work was there was not just one diet that worked for everybody. There were principles behind it. And I think that's the framework that we need to get back to as a starting point. And what's that framework look like for you these days? If somebody came to you as you're a health coach and you work with doctors and patients, and they said, I just want to get my health back. I want to improve my vitality. I want to lose some weight or put on some weight, depending on whether they're undernourished or over-satiated. Where's your starting point?
Yeah, you have to start with that ancestral view. I think that's really important. And I think some people think paleo, you know, it's played out or something, you know, I don't know. Or they try to debunk it. It's almost impossible to debunk if you think about it as just, this is where humans came from. This is how we're supposed to eat. So you have to have an evolutionary context. I think that's important. But then you also have to have a scientific approach. So with the film, we're looking at all of this, right? I don't want to just, and I also don't want to subscribe one diet, right? There's so many different ways to eat. You need to find a framework where we can figure out what are these patterns. So you're right. The patterns would be complete protein, right? That's the building blocks of humans, right? We need that complete protein, whatever that source is. And, you know, some people think you need more. Some people think you need less. I think it's great because it comes along with satiety. You're going to feel full if you're eating protein, and you're going to give what your body needs. And you don't want to lose weight by losing your own lean body mass. That's not a good thing. Some people do. If you're eating maybe like a juice fast, you're going to lose weight, but you're going to lose your own body mass as well. Your lean muscle mass and fat. So you want to maintain protein. It wants to be complete. So a lot of, you know, seafood and animal products have great complete protein. You want nutrient density. You want low energy density. So that means no excess, you know, carbs and sugar. Just, they're not inherently bad, maybe, but they do bad things to a lot of people, and they do provide a lot of excess energy or calories that we don't need when it's not providing us with vital nutrients. So you focus on that, focus on satiety, feeling full. Obviously, the biggest problem with people is they're overeating, right? If they're gaining weight, it's because they're hungry, or maybe it's not even because they're hungry. Maybe it's, you know, they have boredom or coping or emotional eating. There's other stuff. But, you know, we can't attack all of that. So whole foods is another one. very easy. Everyone talks about it, but it's true. You know, it's everyone talks about it for a reason. It's not some, you know, hippie, you know, grandma type of thing. This is absolute truth. And healthy fats, you know, find those healthy fats. They're essential to life. That's one of the big things we got wrong. You know, one of the big food lies is that, you know, saturated fat is bad and cholesterol is bad. And the last thing I'd say is anti-inflammatory, right? Mm. A lot of foods, and I know you agree with this, they're not made for our modern humans, right? There's a big mismatch between all the modern foods we have and what humans are meant to eat and thrive on. And that's why they're called the mismatch diseases, some people call it. And it makes a lot of sense that these grains aren't good for us. This excess sugar is not good for us. Some people don't do well with dairy. Some people don't do well with different, you know, nuts. So yeah, figure out what's not working for you, but then also know that a lot of this stuff is bad for a lot of people. And you may not even know that it's bad, that it's causing these problems. You may think you're doing fine. You're like, yeah, you know, I'm eating bread and balanced diet. And then you don't realize that the problems it was causing until you get rid of them.
I touched on this in the Magic Pill, and we included an inspirational lady called Leah Keith, who wrote the book, The Vegetarian Myth. Mm. And it was really interesting when we were putting together the film, because my director, Rob, actually interviewed the head of the Vegan Welfare Association. And the inclusion in the first edit of the film, it didn't feel right for me, because it felt like what came out of this person's mouth, it would have been very easily for people to ridicule and to go down that path. And I had a concerted effort, and my intention for this film was not to alienate anybody or to attack any belief system or anything under that, except for planting the seeds as to how the large base multinational food corporations can influence science. And just for people to see that. And we covered that with the Tim Noakes trial, and I think we did that beautifully. But what Leah Keith, who was a vegan for 20 odd years or more, what she managed to do with her description of how letting a herbivore do what it's meant to do on the land instead of planting monocrops was quite profound. And I'm interested to know, because I know that you believe a vegan diet is one of the food lies that's out there and that's being perpetuated, as you said, with What the Health and these other films that are out there. So I want to know, how are you going to tackle this in a way that can share the information that you've learned from the experts in a way that, how do you handle this gently, or are you not going to handle it gently?
No, I definitely am going to handle it gently. And I love Leah Keith. I loved her book, and I did a nice long podcast with her. I didn't get her in the film. You already did that. But I think that it's more about looking at this from a different perspective. It's gently talking to people about, hey, you know, maybe we had this wrong. And she does a good job of that, because she still has the same beliefs. She still has a lot of the core beliefs of a vegan without being anywhere near a vegan, right? But what she talks about as a core beliefs is compassion and doing what's right, but it's not always what you think. Basically, I think vegans kind of have it wrong. They come at it from I respect them a lot for their views and their standpoints, but I think that they're just wrong, and we have been told this for a long time that isn't necessarily true. I'm not saying this just well, but for about 50 years, it's been popular to be on this side of all animals are bad, right? Maybe that did start in the 60s with the hippies, where it just seems like this was the right way to go. And it's influenced a lot of things. And we've gotten a lot of science pushed in that direction, and they've been voicing their opinion louder than, you know, the other side. It's not popular to be on a pro meat side, you know, and I don't want to be super pro meat. I just don't want to be anti meat, you know, and I think there's ways to do farming correctly. And Leah talks about it. And I also did go film with Joel Salatin, which you did, which was awesome. And he's an amazing guy, and he loves animals, very compassionate. But there's a way to do it that's almost the exact opposite of what vegans like to portray as what's going on, right? It's there, all these animals aren't, you know, in horrible conditions, jammed in cages. Like they, all animals spend 2/3 of their lives on pasture. Then yes, a large portion go to a feedlot, but that feedlot is actually very efficient, and it's actually a place where they have more attention. They have vets on site. They have nutritionists, animal nutritionists on site getting, you know, making sure they get proper nutrition and they're cared for. The methane arguments are overblown. You know, that using animals correctly actually puts carbon back in the soil. It's almost the opposite a lot of what the vegans say. So I would just like a more honest discussion about what goes on.
It's an interesting thing because even last night I was at work, we were doing the TV show, and somebody, one of the contestants, was like, my sister's pregnant and she's a vegan at the moment. And, you know, I was like, whoa, okay, that's an interesting concept for somebody living in Australia, that, you know, there's so much knowledge out there about, say, the Western A price model. You know, it's steeped in evolutionary history that every hunter-gatherer tribe would celebrate the kill of an animal. And there was an immense amount of respect there. And also the knowledge that came from that, that every part of it would be used and it would be used effectively. And as you said earlier, it was used for the coming generations, whether it was to feed the father and mother that were coming in to expect their first child or their children through it, or to give into the children as they're growing up for optimal health. And these are the organ meats, and these are the things that we know have the most nutrient density. So, I mean, it was interesting last night having this conversation with this person, and he's like, I don't know what to do. And I'm like, I really don't know what to do. Maybe share a podcast with Leah Keith and just say, hey, this might be something to consider. You know, I don't want to guide you in any way, but have you heard of this?
Yeah.
You know, because there seems to be more and more people that are adopting this way of life. And it's funny, 25 years ago, I also became a vegan for 4 years because I'd heard the information. Go vegan, save the planet. Go vegan, improve your health. Go vegan, blah, blah, blah. And I was fully invested 4 years until my health deteriorated to the point where it was like, this is not working for me, and I'm following all the rules that have been given. And I had to make a choice, look after self and get to a point of back to balance, or continue an ideology and a belief. And I still hold true many of those beliefs. How do we protect the planet? How do we look after the animals? How do we actually create a more connected society back to nature? How do we ensure that the animals that are being farmed are being encouraged? And now I'm an ambassador for the largest organic grass-fed, grass-finished meat meat in Australia. And I did a cooking class 2 nights ago with this organization, and I said, what's the percentage of animals in Australia that are sold that are organic and grass-fed and grass-finished, for instance, if we're talking about cattle? And they said 2%. They said 2%. I was like, wow. So 98% of the cattle in this country are not raised organically or holistically. And that was really quite shattering. And I did an interview many years ago with a fellow called Andrew Gunther, who was the head of animal welfare in America. And I think it was around those percentages as well. And his goal was to get it up to about 15% over the next 10 or 15 years. And I was like, wow, you know, it's going to change very slowly, very incrementally, but there is hope because there's people wanting that. And the work that you're doing and the film that you're doing, that is only going to encourage and help change the landscape and the conversation about this.
Yeah.
And I like your approach that not one diet fits all, but let's go back to a foundational, what the foundations are for optimal health, and then tweak it for age, for culture, for resources, for whatever it is that brings you back into alignment and that great health space. So I want to ask you now, where are you at with the film? Because I believe that you're up to crowdfunding at the moment.
Yeah, we're on Indiegogo now. We've done some crowdfunding, and I didn't want to take funding from anyone. You know, I wanted to kind of do this independently, not rely on people that were going to change the vision or some other company that might have their own agenda. So yeah, we're on Indiegogo. We love support, but we're kind of doing this on our own. I have a producer partner and we're kind of self-funding half of it. Really, I'm matching everything that people put in. Not that I have any money, but to me, this is just my passion. This is just my life now. So I'm just putting my own money towards it, and just however it gets made, we're making it happen. And we've actually filmed all of the expert interviews. We've gotten amazing people, about 12 amazing experts. And yeah, we're kind of doing some more stories here in Los Angeles, still filming and starting post-production.
So where can people find out more if they want to donate to get this through to its final stages quicker than you've got it at the moment?
Well, it's foodlies.org. And from there, you can get to the Indiegogo page. And that would be amazing.
Fantastic. And I want to take a step back, because the one thing that you mentioned to me prior to this interview is human beings and their brain size.
Oh, yeah.
And my dear friend Nora Gagaudis talks about this, and I always find it probably the most compelling reason as to why an ancestral diet should be the norm for everybody. But I'd like for you to talk about that in a little bit greater detail for me, and what it was like for you when you discovered this information, what it actually is for anyone that's never heard of it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's mind blowing. When you discover this kind of information, you just, everything clicks into place and you realize, how did we get this so wrong? Or how is this even debatable? You know, but human evolution, we didn't evolve to eat meat. We evolved because we ate meat. That's a great quote that I've heard. And, you know, vegans will say, oh, well, we started as chimps and we should be eating fruit like them. And that's all they eat. You know, they're frugivores and all leaves and plants. That's all we need. And I'd say, no, well, we've come a long way. That was 7 million years ago. I mean, we've split off and so much stuff has happened. And when you look at the course of history, our brain size tracked with our food, technology, and what we ate. And a lot of scientists say that that's when our brain size doubled, is when we started eating meat, and specifically cooking meat. That gives us access to more nutrients. That's the nutrient density thing I'm talking about, is before we would scavenge meat, and, you know, maybe after a lion got to it, we would come and eat that, and we'd eat it raw. But then we improved our nutrient density by figuring out how to use tools and figuring out fire and cook it. And then we figured out how to hunt. And then we figured out how to have first access to that meat. And then we got to get those organ meats and all the good stuff that the lion goes for first. All animals naturally go for the most nutrient dense foods, like the organ meats. And so we, you know, before we were left with the scraps, but now we had first access to these and got to eat these and cook them. And at the same time, we were developing speech probably, and, you know, communicating more, and our brains were, you know, getting bigger, and no one, you know, knows exactly why it happened, or if just this greater access to nutrient density facilitated the growing of our brain. But this all, we just got healthier and healthier, and our digestive system changed. So we aren't like our ancestors, chimps. We have a shorter digestive tract that isn't meant to, you know, slowly ferment and digest a lot of plant foods. It, you know, it's more set up for an omnivorous diet, so we can do both. So we were at a very good place in humanity for a long time, and we lived pretty long lives, even though we had a lot of accidental deaths for infants or accidents or different diseases that, you know, we can now prevent, but we actually lived long, healthy lives and didn't have all these modern diseases. And then the agricultural revolution came around, or we invented agriculture, depending on, you know, there's different estimates, but around 10,000 years ago, we started having grains, and there's a actual line in the sand you can see in the archaeological record where a paleoanthropologists can look at a skeletal remains and say if it was pre-agriculture or post-agriculture, because our brain actually started to decline in size and our robustness went down. Our, you know, our height went down. This is when we started eating these modern foods, and it helped us formed societies and cities, and you know our population expanded and boomed, but our health started to decline. So that was really interesting to me. And I read Protein Power recently. I think you mentioned this on another podcast I was listening to. And the Egyptians were actually in very poor health. People, you know, this is when they started eating all these grains. And it just, this was, people say, oh, well, why should we eat like our ancestors? You know, or our health has been declining since the minute we started eating all these grains. So that was really interesting to me.
if you want to have a functioning brain, and I love listening to Dave Asprey's podcast as well, because he's the master biohacker, and I have a great deal of respect for the work that he does. And you know, his is always about how do we optimize our brain function. Mm-hmm. And same with Nora Gagaudis as well, from Primal Body, Primal Mind. These two individuals love talking about the brain and how to optimize it. And they both believe that eating good quality protein and fat, especially fat, is the optimal way of ensuring that our cognitive abilities will keep us going and be optimal into our late ages in our own personal lives. And it's one of the driving forces for me, to be honest with you, is to ensure that my brain is functioning to the best of its capacity for as long as possible. You know, it's my driving force. And it's interesting because I've just finished a book that I'm releasing next year, and it's called HEAL. Basically stands for healthy eating and living. It's a new brand that I'm creating. And I was going back through because my publisher said, you know, why is this so important to you? And I had this realization, and it brought me back to this memory when I was 14 years of age and I had a traumatic head injury. I was run over by a surfboard. A longboard or a Malibu when I was 14 years, and it fractured my skull and split me open, and I needed 50 stitches and emergency surgery. And I was very close to dying. But the one memory that I have is being wheeled down to the emergency room, and the medics that were there were wheeling me down going, everything's okay. And the only thing I was asking them was, can you give me some mathematics equations? At the age of 14, I just said, give me some mathematics. Let me know if my brain is working. That was my biggest fear. It wasn't about dying. It wasn't about the pain. It was, at the age of 14, will my brain still function from this traumatic injury?
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I was writing these words the other day, I was like, wow, no wonder I've been sort of searching for this path, because I've had this underlying fear. Obviously, I don't think I'm the smartest guy in the world, and I struggle with certain concepts and ideas and how to vocalize things, and I'm working through them. But it was really fascinating to actually put the pieces together, and it's like, wow, I'm actually on this path to actually keep ensuring that my brain keeps
working.
And I've got to get rid of the fear of that, but I'm slowly doing that. But I love it, because without our brains and without our minds and our bodies functioning properly, we can become a burden, and we can not live the lives that we're destined to live, which is one of complete creativity and expression.
Absolutely. And Alzheimer's is shown in studies to be the disease people fear the most. And it's so scary to think that your brain is going to stop working. And I have a little philosophy too. It's like, how are you going to stick to a way of eating? Pretend we all know what we should be eating, you know, whole foods and this kind of thing. Well, how am I going to do that? I need daily motivation to stick to this way of eating. So I like to think there's the very short term, there's a medium term, and the long term. And the long term is definitely, you have to think to your future self that you want to keep your brain intact, and that it very likely seems that what you eat can very much affect if you will express Alzheimer's genes and you know keep your brain health. So that's a very long term, or just to be healthy, to, you know, your future grandchildren, play with them and be around for them. But then there's a very short term is, how am I going to feel after I eat this? Right. Another reason why I don't eat carbs or sugar is because I'm going to feel bad after I eat it immediately. You know, it tastes good while you're eating it, and then you feel bloated or tired. Gross. And then there's, you know, the medium term is like, do I want to look good? All right. I don't want to just get fat. So I feel like there's all kinds of short, medium term, long ways to keep you in line.
Mm. Well, I think it's only fair that I need to be honest with you, is that that's actually my next documentary that I'm starting to put the pieces together. So just in case you're going to be making the same one, I'm just putting it out there. That's my next venture, because I strongly feel passionate about how do we switch on our brains? How do we awaken to our true potential? How do we expand our consciousness? And how do we connect back to nature in this very interesting world that we have manifested and created for ourselves at this particular point in time in history? So I'm looking forward to sharing that with you all, and awesome. It's going to be a blast.
That sounds great. Yeah, that's not that's different. I'm planning a second movie as well, but it's not that, so... We're good.
Awesome. We're good. Mate, I'd love to know, I'd love to finish up this podcast with one of your recipes for life that you cannot give without, or one of your ingredients for your recipe of life that excites you, that you would love to share with people, that may give them a little bit of an insight into possibly an area of their life that may need some rebalancing or some inspiration, because you seem like a guy that likes to get things done.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think participating in an activity, a sport with people, is my recipe for life. I think that's so important. Over my life, I've always participated in sports, but I'm not saying everyone needs to participate in sports. Not everyone can do that, but there's so many benefits to having that social interaction, that thing that you're looking forward to, you know, once a week. Something that's weekly too. I don't think, you know, oh, well, I go skiing like twice a year. I don't mean that. I mean, find something that you can do weekly that's going to keep you in check too, right? It's like, why am I going to not eat this ice cream sundae? Well, I know I have my basketball league on Tuesday, right? And I want to be good for that league. So I'm not going to eat this sundae. So there's so many aspects. Obviously, movement and exercise are so important. The social interaction, getting out in the sun. There's so many things that, so many benefits you get when you're just participating in some kind of activity with a group. So it could be beach volleyball, or it could be just playing, I don't know, bocce ball. It doesn't have to be super athletic, you know, if you're older or you're not able to do, you know, play football. But I think that there's something that everyone can do on a regular basis that gets you outdoors, gets you moving, gets you with friends, and keeps you in check. And I continue to do that every week. I do play Tuesday basketball. I'm in flag football leagues, American football. I play beach volleyball. You know, these are things that make my life so much better, and there's so many benefits. So definitely that.
And it can be anything for anyone. My mum does dancing every week, and I'm just about to, after this podcast, go and pick up my daughter and take her to her touch football. And my other daughter is about to do 5 hours of dancing. And Chili, my first daughter, who's doing touch, is then going to do 4 hours of dancing in a group. And they've been doing that since they were 3 years old, and they're now 12 and 13. So for 10 years, every week, by their choice, they do many hours of dancing in a group. And you can just see the joy when you drop them off, that they're going into their little tribe of like-minded friends and individuals to express themselves and create that energy and that dance and that connection from self to others. And it's a beautiful thing. I love to go surfing myself. And even where I live, there's an ocean pool, and my wife and I regularly walk down there. And it's interesting. I see the older generation down there, people in their 70s and 80s, that are there every single day. And they go for the swim in the ocean pool, regardless if it's raining or if it's foggy or if it's sunny. It's part of their daily ritual to walk down there, connect with the others in their tribe, and have a dip, which obviously there's benefits for the cold water therapy and also getting out into the sun. But I tell you what, they're all bloody happy. And there's some great take-home knowledge there. And if we're willing to open our eyes and our hearts to seeing how simple it is to connect, and the activity can be as low strenuous as it needs to be, or as high intensity as it needs to be, depending on where you are at and what you need to express in your life, and what energy you have, and how you want to get rid of it or attach it. So, Brian, this has been a wonderful podcast, and I wish you all the best for your film Food Lies. And I just want to say I love you. And I am sure the listeners to this podcast are going to jump onto your crowdfunding page and help you get this out to the world, because the more information that is out there, the more the conversation can be created, the more people can then start, after the seeds are planted, for them to do their own research and maybe even pick up the book of Westaday Price from nearly 90 years ago and go down that rabbit hole and educate themselves and educate others.
Absolutely. That's the number one goal. And thank you so much for having me on, for this opportunity to share it with more people. And yeah, let's just get the word out there. And I think we can all be healthier and happier.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.